to New York City and Broadway. The League of New York Theaters and Producers is proud to present the American Theater Wing's 38th Annual Tony Awards, given for excellence in the Broadway theater.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to My Little Tonys, the podcast where we discuss the highlights and the lowlights of Broadway seasons of yore.
I'm Anna.
And I'm Tim.
We are here to discuss the first part of the 1984 Tony Awards. And what we're going to focus on for this episode is one of the biggest, I think, Tony showdowns, definitely of the 80s, maybe of all time, which is Jerry Herman's La Cage aux Folles versus Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George. So the ceremony was on June 3rd, 1984, and about 10.3 million people watched it. The best musical nominees that year were La Cage aux Folles, which had 9 nominations and won 6, Sunday in the Park with George, which had 10 nominations and won 2, Baby, which had 7 nominations and won 0, and The Tap Dance Kid, which had 7 nominations and won 2. And then the new plays were The Real Thing, which had 7 nominations and won 5, Glengarry Glen Ross, which had 4 nominations and won 1, Noises Off, which had 4 nominations and won 0, and Play Memory, which had 2 nominations and won 0.
And on paper, I would argue that this year looks really simple in a lot of ways. Looking back at 1975, where there are just so many shows and, you know, things seem all over the place, I feel like it's just, you know, these two shows are really in a deadlock.
Yeah, and I kind of feel bad for the other shows this season, because there is also a Candor and Ebb show in contention that is not even nominated for Best Musical, called The Rink.
I think what makes that especially sad for me is that they consider it their best show, or the show that means the most to them.
It's too bad. And also, just like this Tony ceremony, in terms of the entertainment value of the show, I think is maybe the best one we've watched so far. Because I think they realize that this is probably the last time that they're going to have, like, these three legendary composers / composing teams all having new shows in one season. Mm-hmm. So it's really structured as a tribute to, like, the first third is a tribute to Candor and Ebb, then the middle is a tribute to Sondheim, and then the last third is a tribute to Jerry Herman. And you have pretty much all of their shows represented by one or two songs. You have some of the original performers doing it. You have some new people doing it. It's a really good show.
Yeah, I agree that this, out of all the shows that we've covered so far, is the strongest. It reads more of as a night of entertainment than, you know, an award show. I feel like in a lot of ways, I was surprised when they would announce the award.
Sometimes they kind of had segues for it, but there were a couple of times where they didn't. Like, there was a part where they, you know, did a little bit of cabaret, and they were like, cabaret won best costumes, and now we're gonna present best costumes. But there was one part where they, like, did a song, I don't remember what it was, and then someone comes out and is like, now is a great time to present best lighting.
What more appropriate moment could there be to list the nominees for outstanding lighting design?
The hosts were Julie Andrews and Robert Preston, and they really didn't do too much. Like, I guess this was before the host would really have an opening number that they would perform or participate in. And all they do, their intro is they come out, they actually talk about something that we've talked about on the podcast before, which is, like, what music is used to introduce them.
With your host, Robert Preston.
Did you notice the music? 76 trombones from the Music Man. I had the joy of playing that musical on Broadway for a couple of years, about 18 years ago. And I also had the added joy of making the movie of the same name. Ever since then, every time I've come out on a stage anywhere, I've been played on by that music.
But it's kind of funny the way they did it, because they're like, guess what song Julie Andrews gets to introduce her? And it was the first time I heard it, it was such, like, a weird jazzy arrangement. I was like, what song is this?
Now watch and see what happens when my smashing co-host comes out. Listen to what they play. Miss Julie Andrews.
And then then, of course, once she said it, I was like, oh, yeah, I can hear it. But and also because of the quality of the recording.
With that being said, I feel like the jazzy reorchestrations of Sunday in the Park with George are also very confusing. I'm like, this sounds so familiar.
So the other theme running throughout this show is Al Hirschfeld got an honorary Tony. It was the Brooks Atkinson Award. And he has, you know, famously done a lot of, you know, Broadway and pop culture caricatures over a very long career. He has like a really cute speech.
And my thanks to all you wonderful actors who have been my models without pay. And my thanks to the producers who've invited me to all their opening nights with free theater tickets. So you see, I'm deeply indebted to the theater for allowing me to live way beyond my means, just like everybody else.
Yeah, no, it's very sweet. And what I really love is after Robert Preston and Julie Andrews do their little opening, the cast of characters that perform all the medleys from all the composing teams are introduced. Instead of showing a little picture of them, they show the caricature on this humongous map of all of them.
And also, just a side note, his book is very worth getting because, you know, not only is he a great artist, but like he writes these really funny little captions next to them that are very kind of pithy, and it really encapsulates the sense of humor that you see in his drawings also.
And also throughout the performances there are, and this feels really in some ways inspired by Sunday in the Park with George, is there are these cutouts of, you know, his like life-size cutouts of his caricatures from the shows that are being presented.
Yes, I loved that. And the first two Tonys of the night go to Sunday, which end up being the only two that it takes the whole time.
Yeah, and such a hotly contested Tony show off between the two shows. You know, if I were watching in real time and didn't know what would happen, I would probably be saying to myself, Sunday is going to sweep.
Yeah. And then, you know, the next two are Best Score and Best Book, which both go to La Cage, which I think at that point everyone was like, And when they announce Best Score, they like, I was trying to listen, you know, like get out the applause meter to see like who they were more, like who got more applause. And I think it was Jerry Herman by a tiny, tiny margin.
La Cage au Folle, music and lyrics by Jerry Herman. Sunday in the Park with George, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim.
So, and then we have, speaking of Jerry Herman winning Best Score, we have his infamous comment that is taken as a jab at Sondheim.
This award forever shatters a myth about the musical theater. There's been a rumor around for a couple of years that the simple, hummable show tune was no longer welcome on Broadway. Well, it's alive and well at the Palace.
I think it is a jab at him, but I think it's also like him referencing the fact that in the 70s he had three huge flops, like, and people I think maybe thought his career was over, or like he was very demoralized about it. And this is sort of, and you know, Mac and Mabel, which we talked about, not even nominated for Best Score, even though it got 8 Tony nominations. And so I think he intended that to be like, you know, you like me, you really like me, but it ended up seeming like, you know, him gloating about his, you know, quote unquote hummable songs winning over the more intricate complexity of Sondheim's score for Sunday.
Yeah, and thinking about that out of the context of who Jerry Herman is, I always thought that that was a really catty jab at Sondheim, but I think that your reading of it actually makes more sense in what I've learned about how milquetoast and mild-mannered Jerry Herman is. He's not a
rabble-rouser.
Yeah, he's not a rabble-rouser. He doesn't even drink.
Really?
Yeah, and I was reading a biography of him, and after La Cage, everyone wanted to take him out for a date, and he would go out for Coca-Colas with...
I mean, he does have that kind of sweet, innocent face.
Yeah.
That's really funny, though. The first two big awards go to La Cage, and also all the other big awards. So, La Cage au Folle is based on, many people think it is based on the French movie of the same name, but it's actually based on the original play by Jean Poiret because they could not get the rights to the movie. Music and lyrics by Jerry Herman, book by Harvey Fierstein. It was directed by Arthur Lawrence, who was, you know, a former heavy Stephen Sondheim collaborator, and he also kind of has a low-key, bitchy thing in his speech.
From the first day that I met with Harvey Fierstein and Jerry Herman, La Cage aux Folles has been the most joyous and affectionate experience I've ever had in the theater.
And you know, whenever people say that in award shows, I always think that's very rude because on the one hand, it is nice to say that, but it's also like, other people you've collaborated with are probably in the room.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. And I think that the tone of his speech is so different from things that he was even saying a few weeks later in interviews.
The synopsis is, La Cage aux Folles centers on a Saint-Tropez drag show nightclub owned by George and headlined by his longtime love, Albin. The couple raised George's son, the product of a youthful one-night stand together. But when young Jean-Michel gets engaged to the daughter of a right-wing politician determined to crack down on gay nightlife, George feels compelled to pretend to have a normal family, with Albin taking on the masculine persona of Uncle Al. Will Jean-Michel's future in-laws be fooled?
You know, its first preview was August 9th, 1983, which, for those of you listening at home, August 9th is my birthday. It had a really successful experience out on the road. It only ran for 15 previews and then opened August 21st of the same year. And it ran for 1,761 performances.
A little bit of an aside, so La Cage aux Folles, the movie, at the time it came out in 1978, and it was the most popular foreign film I think of all time at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it has two sequels, both of which sound absolutely insane. The plot of the first one is a spy plants a capsule of microfilm on Albin, and from then on, spies and government agents pursue him. Albin and Renato, whose name was changed to George for the musical, travel to Italy to hide at Renato's mother's farm. At each point along the way, we see the straight world's reaction to Albin. And then, La Cage aux Folles 3, in order to inherit his Aunt Emma's large fortune, which includes a large chunk of Scotland, Albin must marry a woman and father a child, and Renato goes along with the plan in an attempt to save their Saint-Tropez nightclub. Albin consults marriage broker Matrimonia and tries to act like a conservative heterosexual, but all attempts to conform fail and he considers suicide. When all hope seemed to be lost, Renato and Albin meet a suicidal young woman, Cindy, who decides that marrying Albin may be better than death. So
we were talking about this earlier in the week, but we could only hope that the Call Me By Your Name sequels have as crazy of plot lines as those. Thinking about this as one of the most popular foreign films of that era, it provides some context that this was like a story, and I don't think it would technically classify as a franchise at this point, but you know, this was something that people were familiar with and a depiction of homosexuality that people were able to swallow. And while America was eating this movie up, Jerry Herman himself in 1978 went to go see a screening of it with his friend Chuck Foltz. And Foltz remembers that Jerry was so excited by this film that he squoze my arm so tightly that after the movie, I still had a mark. And as we were leaving the theater, he said, "That's my next musical. I know just what to do with it."
Oh, wait, I didn't know that, because originally it started out with a totally different creative team. Alan Carr, who had produced the film of Grease, he hired J. Preston Allen to write the book, Maury Yeston, who wrote the score for Nine, to write the score, and Mike Nichols to direct and Tommy Toon to choreograph, and it was going to be called The Queen of Basin Street, and it would be set in New Orleans. And then as soon as they brought in executive producers, they just fired everyone, because I think they were like, these people are going to be too expensive, and brought in everyone else, and everyone sued, and only Maury Yeston won and is getting like a small amount of royalties from the show. But as a funny coda, Mike Nichols is also present at this Tony's because he directed The Real Thing. And then 10 years later, he would direct the American remake of La Cage called The Birdcage, which features several Sondheim songs in it. And I think Sondheim even wrote an original song for it. So everything really comes full circle with this. I came into this knowing like the big songs, and I mean, I don't think it's a secret to anyone who listens to this that we are really in the bag for Sondheim, but I don't think either of us are anti Jerry Herman at all. And even though he he just likes to write a big old-fashioned, simple, satisfying musical comedy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And at its heart, even though it was very trailblazing by having two gay men and having a gay couple at the center of like this huge expensive Broadway musical, in every other way, like it's an extremely conventional show.
Mm-hmm.
In Frank Rich's review of the show, he wrote, "The show at the Palace is the schmaltziest, most old-fashioned major musical Broadway has seen since Annie, and it's likely to be just as popular with children of all ages. Were you hoping for a little more? I must confess that I was. The glitz, showmanship, good cheer, and almost unflagging tunefulness of La Cage aux Folles are all highly enjoyable and welcome. But in its eagerness to please all comers, this musical is sometimes as shamelessly calculating as a candidate for public office." So that was from his review. And then he's later writing in an editorial about why it's such a blockbuster hit. Like people, they talk about how they were nervous to preview in Boston, which is like a very conservative town. But like everybody loved it. Like people were lining up out the door. Like their advance was huge before they even opened on Broadway. So he writes, "Now that the show has finally been officially unveiled, it's easier to see what makes it tick, and perhaps what so many prescient theatergoers sniffed about in advance. La Cage aux Folles is an extravagantly produced, old-fashioned family musical containing likable characters, who, whatever their sexual preferences, are people, not cats. A sentimental love story, sumptuous sets and costumes, and, that rarity, new songs that can be hummed on the way home. Given these real virtues and its overall line of attack, La Cage aux Folles might be a hit even if its heroes were Internal Revenue agents. We don't see many shows in this one's anachronistic style anymore, and it's a vacuum that was aching to be filled. When an old-fashioned musical arrives on Broadway now, it's either an outright revival or a show like 42nd Street or My One and Only that has been built around vintage songs. Whatever their other attractions, such musicals can't pack that special thrill that comes when we discover a pretty melody in a theater for the first time. Our new-fashioned musicals, meanwhile, tend to be spectacles built around a somewhat static theatrical idea, Cats, or bookless pop operas with rock-flavored scores, Dreamgirls, Evita, or abrasive accounts of contemporary alienation, 9. La Cage aux Folles isn't better than all these shows, but it isn't like them either. It's a throwback to the kind of hit musical that dominated Broadway before rock music was invented, before revivals and reviews were ubiquitous, and before innovators like Michael Bennett and Harold Prince opted for building musicals around themes and Brechtian staging techniques instead of storybook plots."
I think that while its traditionalism harkens back to so many things that we already know and love, I think that in bringing that to the table in the 80s, Jerry Herman is in some way doing something that no one else is doing.
It's true. And so it had an all-gay creative team, and Arthur Lawrence, the director, and Harvey Fierstein, who wrote the book, were both very politically active. And I think there was talk of making it like a little bit more radical. And Jerry Herman was the one who was kind of the mitigating influence and was like, "No, like, I just want to make something old-fashioned. I want to make something mainstream where you have a good time." And that ended up really being the right instinct.
You know, Harvey Fierstein is 28 years old at this point, and he is brought on to the project because of the success of Torch Song, which at this point is a long-running series of 3 one-act plays that has been fashioned into a longer one evening of theater that really, in a lot of ways, has captured the gay experience of the time. He starred in it originally, and it's a slightly autobiographical view of like what it means to be gay in New York in the 80s.
And he is also a drag queen.
Yeah, and he himself was a drag queen. So that show, you know, had its humble beginnings at La Mama, and, you know, before he's 30, Harvey has made this name for himself and is, you know, working with arguably two of the biggest names in the musical theater of yesteryear.
Although, even though he wins the Tony, his book was singled out in almost all of the reviews I read, including of new revivals as being the worst part of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably because, you know, it's adapted from a farce, which, you know, has kind of thin and stereotypical characters, and it's being refashioned to be kind of a more three-dimensional story. But I think they're only really successful in doing that with George and Albin, and all of the supporting characters really end up being very unlikable caricatures.
The true message of the show is that Harvey himself has said this, that it's really about honor thy mother and father and not really making any big claims about the gay experience. I think it's something that is pointed out in the John Bush Jones, Our Musicals Ourselves, that I found very intriguing, is that he mentions that Lacage was not the first gay musical of its variety. You know, the season before in May, Alan J. Lerner's last show, Dance a Little Closer. A little over 3 months before the hit Lacage opened, another show opened that had no run at all but is historically significant as the first mainstream Broadway musical to depict a gay male love affair. Alan J. Lerner loosely adapted Dance a Little Closer from Idiot's Delight, Robert E. Sherwood's 1936 Pulitzer Prize-winning apocalyptic and, not incidentally, isolationist drama. With music by Charles Strauss, Dance a Little Closer was librettist and lyricist Lerner's final and failed bid for one more hit. The show closed the night it opened. Yet Lerner's open depiction of homosexuality in a Broadway musical for general audiences cannot go unremarked. The 83-year-old Lerner said he risked doing this because I wanted to make a statement about love being essential to all lifestyles. I have to admit, some people have been critical of my including the two boys in the story, but I found you have to write something because you believe in it.
That's a very sweet sentiment.
Yeah.
But as Harvey says, Lacage was the first gay musical to make money, yeah. Which is all that matters. The show did have a breakout hit with I Am What I Am, which was recorded by, I think, Gloria Gaynor. It was recorded by a few people, and it became like a big gay anthem and sort of like an anthem of the gay rights movement. And I found something like sort of an interesting little trivia piece. So in Australia in 2004, when the Australian government denied same-sex marriages, a group of gay rights activists formed a micronation called the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the Coral Sea Islands, and I Am What I Am was their national anthem.
That is lovable because it is so much easier to remember the words of this song than it is our national anthem.
Yes, simple words, simple tune. I mean, another important element of context to this was that this was really at the height of the AIDS epidemic and sort of national, like, scaling up of homophobia and sort of fear of, you know, homosexuality. So in that way, it was really radical to present this very low-key, monogamous, like, long-term, you know, gay relationship. And also the cast of Lacage was the first, I think it was them or they and, like, a few other shows were the people who founded Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS and did, like, the first Easter Bonnet fundraiser and all that. So that came out of this show in this time period.
And it is interesting to think about it as, like, a show that's been revived twice in recent years. Because I think that in American theater, obviously, AIDS made such a big impact that I think a lot of people, you know, people really see it as a pre-AIDS show. I think it has been criticized as being a little too fluffy.
And I've seen, because it closed, it did have a long run, but it closed kind of prematurely also. Like, it did, it only ran for about 4 years, and some people, there's you know, kind of like the party line that swirls around is that it's because of AIDS ramping up and people, you know, just like homophobia becoming and the backlash becoming more rampant. But really it was because they had to do renovations on the palace and it was too expensive to move the show to another theater. And I learned that it's because that's something that we've come across while researching like sort of these 60s and 70s shows, is that a lot of times shows would change theaters. And I was like, why does that never happen anymore? And it's because unions. Unions make it too expensive now.
Well, thanks a lot, yeah. Unions.
Thanks, unions.
I wonder, you know, outside of a regular theater-going audience, you know, if an out-of-towner would, what appeal this show would have. You know, someone who's not living in New York or, you know, are a New York Times reading liberal, would this show, even just the suggestion of a show based around a homosexual couple, be too much?
I think that was the goal of this show, was to be a show that is not too much for like an out-of-towner.
Well, it's interesting in reading gay histories of New York before World War II, drag shows and drag performances were a normal thing that would, you know, be written up in the newspaper and weren't seen as this, like, symptom of a sick society that, you know, I think at this time it more so was, or was at a point where people were moving away from that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's a twist on a classic old-fashioned musical. It was the right time. The best of times is now.
And I think that I had unfairly said, when thinking about Jerry Herman, that his merits really lay on the strength of his source material, because I think that, you know, what is most compelling to me about Hello, Dolly is when you get the glimpses of Thornton Wilder in it. But I think that learning more about this show and giving it a fair listen, I have changed my mind.
But the interesting thing is, even though it was a hit, Jerry Herman never wrote a show again. And this book, Broadway Musicals, The 101 Greatest Shows of All Time, has this anecdote at the end. I don't know where this is sourced from because I didn't come across this anywhere else, but with its long run, you might think that the tale of La Cage aux Folles had a typical happy ending. It doesn't, for after all the rough treatment he had received through all the dark years, enduring constant comparisons to the more cerebral Sondheim, Jerry Herman was fed up. When the curtain rang down on opening night of La Cage, Herman walked out onto Broadway, the street to which he had devoted his entire life, vowing to himself never to write another Broadway show. He had nothing more to prove, and sadly, it's a vow he's kept for more than 20 years. Yeah. You can tell when this book was written. And you know what? Why not go out on a high note?
Yeah, no, totally. This is his third show to run for over 1,500 performances. His three successes, and I think that his songbook is one that is well-respected.
Yeah, that was the only hint I read of it being out of bitterness instead of out of just being like, all right, I've done that, and I'm ready to be done. I think that's a good segue into sort of the retrospective medleys leading up to the La Cage performance, unless you have anything else you want to say about it.
I think that one thing I do want to mention, and I don't know where this necessarily fits in, one review that I read claimed that La Cage is just Hello Dolly in drag, which in a lot of ways I agree, but I think what is interesting to me is that the same poster designer that did the poster of MAME also did this poster, and it is literally the same poster, except it's a drag queen. And to the award show, you know, Arthur and Jerry both brought women as dates.
That's true. I was trying to see who they were, but I couldn't really get a good look.
Yeah, I couldn't really get a good look. But Harvey brought his boyfriend, who was a typist, and also thanked him in his speech because he typed all the drafts of the script.
I know, I thought that was so sweet.
So
I have to thank the incredible cast, all the people that were so supportive, even the Torchstone people who kept me company, and of course my lover, Scott, who's typed everything late at night. Thank you all. I love you. Thank you.
Before we talk about the actual performance, we're going to go through the tribute to him.
The best of times is now.
If I had to sum up Jerry Herman in only one word, there is only one word that could be used: optimist.
So the first one, Robert Goulet performs a little bit of Milk and Honey, which was his first show.
Shalom, shalom, you'll find shalom, the nicest greeting you know.
Which is about like a group of old ladies who are like on a bus trip to Israel. So then we move on to Hello Dolly. You get Carol Channing doing Before the Parade Passes By.
Before the parade passes by, I'm gonna get some life back into my life.
And I think that what I love about this is a caricature of...
Yes, they have the waiters, and they bring out like 10 Carol Channing caricatures that they dance with. That's a prop I would really like to get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Uggam sings If He Walked Into My Life from MAME and does an amazing job.
Yeah, I have never heard, like, that is, for me, kind of a forgettable MAME song, but that version of it really sold it.
Yeah,
for me.
She really just puts her back into it.
Did he need a stronger hand? Did he need a lighter touch? Was I soft or was I tough? Did I give enough?
And then they bring out Dorothy Loudon, who we'll talk about later because she is also insane in the Sondheim tribute. But she comes out standing on top of a car in this crazy dress. She's like doing all these. She doesn't sing at all. Like the men in the car, there's like 10 men in the car and they're all singing Mame to her. And she's just doing all these weird like ad libs.
And she literally looks like she walked off set of Dr. Zhivago.
They said I could keep the dress. But I got one just like it at home. So I'm gonna keep the car. And the boys.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with her. She's such a weirdo. And I feel like she's one of those people who, if she did not become a Broadway actor, she would just be like one of those ladies who like screams at you on the street corner.
Yes.
Then we move on to Dear World, and Leslie Uggams also sings I Don't Want to Know.
If music is no longer lovely, if laughter is no longer lilting, if lovers are no longer loving, then I don't want to know.
And then we have a little Mac and Mabel reunion where Robert Preston sings I Won't Send Roses.
I won't send roses or hold the door. I won't remember which dress you wore. My heart is too much in control. The lack of romance in my soul will turn you gray, kid. So stay away, kid.
That song is literally like the anthem of every guy I dated between the ages of like 22 and 27. And then Bernadette sings Time Heals Everything.
And the close up on her face while she's singing it is so,
it's really intense.
Yes.
She's really feeling it.
Time heals everything. Tuesday, Thursday. Time heals everything. April.
And then we have the Lacage performance, and you get to see some of the amazing costumes. So they start singing We Are What We Are.
We are what we are, and what we are is an illusion.
There's like some cool costume stuff where they start out wearing these amazing cloaks, and then this like these kind of like poles come down from the ceiling and like lift their cloaks off, and they're all wearing these little tap costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I was trying to get to the bottom of, which I think I did, but who knows, is that in the ensemble of the drag queens, there are two women in there. And you see it, first of all, when you're listening to the cast recording, they're like mixed pretty high up so you can hear it, so which is kind of weird. And then at the end, they like rip their wigs off so you can see who is a woman. And I was like, why would they do that? And apparently Arthur Lawrence writes about it in his book, but I think his book is a little bit like the gospel according to Arthur Lawrence.
Yeah.
So like you can take it with a grain of salt. But basically he was saying during the development of it, Jerry Herman was writing songs, Harvey Firestein was writing the book. Everyone was like, yeah, yeah, good. Like here are the checks, but they weren't really getting big checks. And then as soon as Arthur Lawrence was like, we're going to have two of them be ladies, everyone was like, amazing. That's such a good idea. Here's all your money.
Yeah.
Do with that what you will.
I think that that's an interesting point to bring up, and I think that this is obviously like a symptom of the time, but I think that this whole conversation about drag and like who's a woman and stuff I think that within the past 10 years has not aged very well.
No. And apparently the big blow up photo of one of the dancers they did was of one of the female dancers like above the theater. Like a big promotional photo.
And fun fact, one of the original female ensemble members in this, Linda Haberman, led the Rockettes for a long time.
Ooh.
She was kind of the dance captain of the Rockettes until 5 years ago.
Well, one of the other ones, I don't know if she was original or a replacement, was Katie Huffman, who would go on to win a Tony for the Producers. Just got some tall ladies with long-ass legs.
Exactly. Doing what they do best.
Yeah. So then it transitions into George Hearn, who is not performing in drag, but he is performing in front of an Al Hirschfeld caricature of himself in drag, doing I Am What I Am. And there's some parts of it that are very Sweeney Todd.
I am what I am. I don't want praise. I don't want pity. I bang my own drum. Something is noise. I think it's pretty.
But I thought it was an interesting choice to cast someone in that role who has a very masculine baritone voice and is not attempting to sing like a woman at all in any of the drag performances.
Yeah, and I also thought that, but then in some of the stuff that I was reading, it was said that he was cast because he does actually have like a really big range.
I mean, he has an amazing voice. It's just, you know, when you're developing mm-hmm. a show like that, it's like, if we're going to have a character that's a female impersonator, like, are the songs going to be written to accommodate a range of someone who is singing like that?
I think that Tony, number-wise, this is actually kind of genius.
Yeah.
Because I think that, to the credit of the creators of this show, I think that the first act being enveloped between We Are What We Are and I Am What I Am is really genius packaging.
Yeah, and everyone, like, I was trying to read people's like personal accounts of seeing it, and everyone says the moment at the end of Act One where he sings this song and like rips off his wig and he storms up the aisle and that's how he exits was just like an incredibly thrilling moment.
Jerry Herman really knows how to close an act.
Yeah. Lacage, we're not mad at it.
I wanted so much to be able to be mad at it. And also, so something that I was totally scandalized by when reading the Jerry Herman biography was that he had written a song, and I think this definitely speaks to your point that, you know, the homophobic parents and laws were total just caricatures. A song that was cut even before the tryouts in Boston was called Have a Nice Day. The biographer Steven Citron writes, "One song, Have a Nice Day, written to be sung by father-in-law, was cut before the tryout in Boston. Full of racial and ethnic slurs, its premise was that if it weren't for the dykes, the kikes, the wops, and the japs, we could all have a nice day. Herman, who gave me access to all his musical and lyrical oeuvre, would not permit any quotation from this song and is reticent about having it performed."
Yikes.
Yeah, so
that, I think if that song had been in there, we would be reading about this show and not since Carrie.
Yes. And I'm sure Arthur Lawrence was like, "What's the matter with it?"
Life's not worth a damn.
So Sunday in the Park with George in many ways is the polar opposite to La Cage aux Folles. You know, so this is very like a pure, like one of the purest distillations between like the musical as art and the musical as entertainment, because you have something like La Cage, which is a huge spectacle. Like it's a crowd pleaser, like very, you know, mainstream in most ways, very old fashioned, even though maybe it doesn't hold up. Like if you sort of analyze the individual pieces, like it really hits you on a visceral level and is like emotionally moving and affecting in that way. And then you have something like Sunday in the Park with George, which is more experimental. It's very complex and it's about these bigger themes, not necessarily a linear plot, and is, you know, alienating to some people, but also very moving to a much smaller group of people than is probably moved by something like La Cage.
I think that perfectly sums it up at this point, as we see through the tribute that's paid to Stephen Sondheim. He has made quite the reputation in the American theater. And this is his first show after 11 seasons and 6 shows collaborating with Harold Prince that he's pursuing a project without Prince in some manner involved.
Right. You know, his collaboration with Hal Prince fell apart in the early 80s when they did Merrily We Roll Along, which was a huge failure. Both critics and audiences hated it. And after that, Sondheim considered just leaving the theater altogether. And then he met James Lapine, who was much younger and, you know, who sort of came from a different generation of theater artists and came up through, you know, this new way of developing shows, like through workshopping and kind of the nonprofit world instead of, you know, Sondheim, who was a real Broadway baby and, like, really had this, you know, was sort of in this older model of developing shows, and his partnership with James Lapine, who wrote the book and directed this, really, like, revitalized him. So this, I feel like this must be the only musical based on a painting, right?
That's a very good question.
So it's based on the painting A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatte and the life of Georges Seurat, who was the painter. And the synopsis is, the days leading up to the completion of his most famous painting, A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatte, Georges Seurat is struggling to make meaningful art and maintaining a relationship with his lover, Dot. Amid the scorn of the artistic community, Seurat's artistic ability thrives while his love diminishes. A century later, Seurat's descendant, named George and also an artist, finds himself burnt out and in search of what artistic path to follow, but he finds the answer to his future in the past.
It's easy enough to provide a synopsis like this, but I think that at large, the plot points that you would traditionally associate with a book of a musical, this doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
Like, I think that this is a really nice tying up of it, and I even remember when I had first, you know, got my hands on the recording and listened to it and kind of had an idea of the synopsis of it. I think I was actually rather surprised when I did see a recording of a production of it.
Yeah, and I think it helps in some ways that Georges Seurat, the historical figure, is kind of a cipher. And, you know, they say he didn't keep diaries. Like, there aren't really many letters from him. He was, like, a very private person, and he died at 31 before receiving any recognition for his work. And not a lot is known about him. So I think that really helps them not feel tied down to any biographical details of him.
No, it's actually very exciting to, you know, imagine the process of writing this for them. And I think that the show makes a lot of statements about works of art where, you know, it isn't just about, like, what you see in front of you. It's about all of the other possibilities and things being filtered through a person's eyes. So I think that the speculative element of it's rather thrilling.
Yeah.
This is a little passage from Our Musicals Ourselves that I found really interesting about the choice of Seurat. When they opted to write a show about art, they could have chosen just about any artist from Michelangelo to Grandma Moses. But Seurat seems to have been more than a happy accident. His pointillistic techniques demands the collaboration of the painting's viewer, observing it from just the right distance, to complete the work of art. Regarding the musical, Lapine said, "A lot of people who come to Broadway come not to work. They come to forget. And that's not what Sunday is about. If you just sit back and watch, you're going to get bored. You really have to listen. And you have to think. Not a lot, but you can't just let it wash over you like certain other shows."
Like certain other shows I could name.
Yes.
I also found, this is from Art Isn't Easy, The Theater of Stephen Sondheim, which is a little more detail about Seurat's painting technique, which is a big part of how Sondheim wrote the score of the musical, which I thought was interesting. Seurat shared the overriding concern of the Impressionist painters for color and light. Artists such as Monet and Renoir, however, found his work too extreme and categorically rejected his canvases, in large part because Seurat adapted the emotional subjectivism of the Impressionists to suit his more rigorously scientific inclination. Where the Impressionists chose pigments and approximated the colors they found in nature, Seurat determined instead to analyze each color phenomenon into its primary components. He then applied minute dots of complementary pure color to his canvas, depending on the perceiver's eye, to fuse the contiguous hues. Microscopic examination reveals that Seurat did not simply juxtapose his brush strokes, but applied the primary and secondary colors in several layers. This optical process, which demanded the active participation of the viewer, resulted in a canvas that shimmered with startling vividness. And then, so Sondheim says about that, he put hundreds of thousands of dots on that canvas, and everyone was a separate decision. Some people say there were 5 million individual decisions, and that's what art is. You spend 4 days working out the flower on the hat, then you spend 10 days working on the hat, then you have 20 other hats to do, then all the hats are part of a pattern, then you start working on the face. It is just hard work.
That's so amazing.
I know.
And I think that the idea, you know, the traditional way of looking at it would be to make it, like, biographical. Like, I just think that this is, like, so much bigger than musical theater in so many ways. Or, you know, at least the musical theater of the time.
Definitely. And I think, I also think it's important to say up top that the inspiration behind doing a musical about this was that I think James Lapine took Sondheim to see the painting at the Chicago, I think it's at the Chicago Museum of Art.
Or Chicago Art Institute.
And they were looking at it and they were like, none of these people are looking at each other. and like what's happening there. And Lapine was like, and it's also missing the main character. And Sondheim was like, who is that? And Lapine was like, the artist. So from there, they were like, we got a show.
Oh my God. No, that is actually truly amazing. Yeah. It's funny, when we talked about 1975, we touched on the Robert Wilson opera of A Letter to Queen Victoria, which is a lot more avant-garde and non-linear than this. But in a lot of ways, I think that, you know, more so than the Rodgers and Hammerstein kind of book musical, I feel like this pays tribute to something like that more.
Yeah. Well, John Lehrer, who was the theater critic for The New Yorker for a long time, he said, Sondheim's strength and his weakness is that he has an avant-garde sensibility in a popular art form, which I think is a perfect way of summing it up. So Sondheim was very inspired by Seurat's, you know, painting style. It's interesting because they're both people who have sort of a scientific view of an art form. Like, Seurat for painting was very scientific and technical, and very concerned with form and order. And Sondheim is very much the same, both in his music and his lyrics. And here's sort of an interesting kind of like going into the music theory of the score a little bit. And this is from a New York Review of Books piece about the show. As for Sunday, says Mr. Sondheim, he sought an analog for Seurat's use of pure color in the use of diatonic rather than chromatic harmonies and simple triadic forms. At one point, he even toyed with the idea of composing the entire score on the white keys of the piano. The idea was to keep the music open and pure the way the painting is, he explains, and to give it a shimmer. I was also fiddling with chord clusters because that seemed to me some kind of possible analog to Seurat's close juxtaposition of different colored dots. Another oral equivalent of Seurat's color schemes, Mr. Sondheim discovered, could be found by repeating musical motifs and certain key words and phrases throughout the score, much the way he did in Sweeney Todd. The romantic section of the opening song, Sunday in the Park with George, for instance, is developed further in a subsequent number, Color and Light, which then becomes the basis for a later song, We Do Not Belong Together, which in turn informs the show's penultimate number, Move On. As a result, what may initially sound like a sequence of separate numbers actually connects, like the painter's dots, to form a highly patterned score that binds the story together, and also grows in resonance with the progress of the show.
Ah!
I know. He just puts so much care and thought into every single word, every single note of every show he does.
I think that in a lot of texts that we've been reading recently, there is this allusion to that there's like a formula of like a Broadway show. But I think that seeing how he is working at this period, you know, he makes his own formula.
I mean, and I think it's because he was raised, like he was a protege of Oscar Hammerstein, who was so really like the innovator of the form of the musical as we know it. So it's like, it's really like you got to know the rules to break them.
And, you know, thinking about some of the things that Hammerstein put forth, like thinking about each song as its like own piece of theater, he's still adhering to those kinds of things, even when at his most experimental.
The first premiere was at Playwrights Horizons. And it was very much a work in progress.
I've read people's accounts of seeing it. They say that when they went to see it, the second act wasn't even finished.
Yeah, they were working on the second act up until the first few Broadway previews. So they were really trying to figure out. And reading about it, there were a lot of different directions that they thought about going with it. Just for a little bit of context. So I'm reading excerpts from a lot of different New York Times pieces. The New York Times, really, a few different people there really were champions of this show, and there would be pieces about it almost every week, so much that people from other shows would kind of snarkily call it Sunday in the Times with George, which I thought was funny. This is a Frank Rich piece about what it means that Sondheim is doing this Playwrights Horizons version. By choosing to develop Sunday in the Park on a low-budget, low-pressure basis at one of Off-Broadway's most imaginative nonprofit theaters, Mr. Sondheim is reordering his priorities. He is opting for creative freedom, from both money men and critics, over the hit-or-miss psychosis of show business. Like Woody Allen, another idiosyncratic artist who chooses to work in the hostile environment of big-budget pop culture, he may have finally found a way to gain full control over his own work. that, I mean, that comparison maybe does not read the same now, but it makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, and I think that the way in which a place like Playwrights Horizons really nurtures creative talent is a lot less evil than Broadway, where they weren't like having critics come when the show wasn't finished to, you know, be writing about it.
Right.
If any critics came at all, it was at that, you know, towards the end of...
Because it's a mostly subscription-based audience.
Yeah, because they were saying, you know, we'll have people in the seats no matter what.
Right, you can put up whatever. And a funny little casting tidbit. So it starred Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters. And Bernadette Peters' last Broadway appearance and last appearance in a musical was 10 years, or almost 10 years earlier, in Mac and Mabel, which was Jerry Herman. And Christine Baranski, who wins this year for The Real Thing, was in that Playwrights Horizons workshop playing the role that eventually was named Yvonne. I think it had a different name there. And I found out Bernadette did do one off-Broadway show in between Mac and Mabel and Sunday, and it was a two-woman off-Broadway play called Sally and Marcia, and the other woman was Christine Baranski.
How about that? You know, I love Bernadette Peters. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that my interest in Broadway was steered in some capacity by her. She, you know, I think that it really felt like this part was written with her in the room.
Part of the development of the show was that they realized that George and Dot really were the emotional core of the show. Like, originally, the other people in the park had a lot more to do, and they, like, had full songs that ended up being cut down to little snippets. They quickly realized that they had to, you know, it's really about Mandy and Bernie.
She really gets to explore a wide range of...
Yeah, she gets to play her own grandmother.
I know, that's like the one thing that if, you know, depending on what course the show could have taken, if you would tell me that one of the proposed ideas was that 100 years later she would be playing her granddaughter in a wheelchair, and, you know, seeing her dressed up as in like old lady drag is more impressive than anything in La Cage aux Folles.
Well, and there are a lot of people who really hate that second act. It doesn't really go anywhere. It's weird. I don't agree with that. I think the second act really really wraps it up and ties it all together beautifully.
You know, the first act is just so beautiful. I can understand why people make that argument, but I don't think that the second act feels like an add-on. I think seeing the same struggles 100 years later does a really interesting thing of making history seem smaller than it is.
Yeah.
And I think it makes an interesting comment on the first act as sort of a period piece.
It's an interesting leap to make, and like, when the curtain comes up again, you kind of expect that the story is going to continue the way that it has been. But it's like, nope, first we're going to have the painting sing as a painting, and then it's 100 years later and we're in the 80s art world.
Yeah, and I think that with how much it's heralded as this like beautiful, emotional, passion-driven score, I think that there's like such an element of fun in comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's... We love it. Yeah. And, you know, so it really went home almost empty-handed, and it won, there's a sort of a parallel in a recent Broadway season with Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812, which was nominated for, I think, 12 Tonys and won the same two that Sunday won, which was lighting and set design. But if it had opened even one season later, 1985 was a very weak year. It was so low on musicals that they didn't even give out the Best Actor and Best Actress in a Musical Tonys that year because there was just not enough people eligible. So it's not, they should have just waited a year and swept 1985.
So, yeah.
You know, feast and famine in the 80s. And Sondheim actually has a big section in his book, in the Sunday in the Park with George section, where he talks about how useless he thinks the Tonys are and awards are. I think it is lucky that or not lucky, but like the lack of Tonys has not diminished Sunday's reputation or its legacy. And it did win. It won the Pulitzer that year, which is, you know, even a bigger deal than the Tonys.
Yeah. In talking about the Tonys in awards in general, he talks about how frivolous, and he makes a really funny comment about how he has so many awards that he could make the mantle fall down. But, you know, he brought up, you know, the fact that the Pulitzer Prize wasn't given to Edward Albee for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf because of content. And so he, even though he thinks the Pulitzer was the prize to win and felt like that was an accomplishment, even finds flaws with that. flaws with like having these bands of critics and academics or, you know, theater professionals be the people judging your work.
Yeah. And I hope it's clear with how we do this that, like, even though we are really focused on the Tonys, that we don't think that, like, the number of Tonys a show gets is the ultimate arbiter of its quality, and that we definitely do, you know, it's just sort of a guideline to see what was in the water that year, you know, like, what was making a stir, what was flying under the radar. But we certainly don't think awards are, like, the be-all, end-all of what is good and bad on Broadway.
In that piece, he has, like, a very interesting. So the three things that awards can offer are cash, confidence, and bric-a-brac. And I believe that's true.
So just like a couple of little tidbits from the development of the show. So one of the earliest versions of Act Two had great moments in the painting's history, taking it like on its journey from France to the Art Institute of Chicago. And then for a while, when they were trying to figure out what kind of artist Act Two George was going to be, for a long time, he was going to be a performance artist with a performing arts troupe. So if you just imagine that Act Two of Sunday in the Park with George was like him doing the Over the Moon section from Rent, and then he was going to do holograms, but that would have been really hard to do on stage. So then they did the chromolooms, which are machine-like sculptures that employ lasers and light. And another interesting thing is that the section where he does the dog voices, like pretends, you know, sort of gets in the heads of the dogs in the park, that was inspired by Sondheim going to a Laurie Anderson concert, and there are different parts where she sang into like a vocoder that changed her voice, and Sondheim was like, what if we had one of those like hidden in the pad, and he would do it, and Mandy was like, I don't need a vocoder, I can just do the voices, and he like auditioned all these different dog voices for them.
Some of his dog voices are really sexy.
I'm learning so much about you through this process. So the Sondheim section starts with another 100 people from company.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up to the ground.
While another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around.
And another 100 people who got off of the plane and are looking at us.
Who got off of the train and the plane and the bus
maybe yesterday.
Many things one might say about Stephen Sondheim and his work, but among them is not that he settles for easy.
Don't check your mind with your coat when you buy your ticket for a Sondheim musical.
And then you have Larry Kurt, who was the original Tony from West Side Story, singing Something's Coming.
There's something due any day, I will know right away, soon as it shows. It'd make him cannonball it down through the sky, gleaming its eye bright as a rose.
And actually, we forgot to mention this in the 75 Tonys because there was so much stuff, but that also had Larry Kurt and Carol Lawrence doing a song from West Side Story also. So he's available to sing West Side Story at the Tonys anytime you want. And then you have Anita Morris doing a very fun You Gotta Get a Gimmick.
Yes, I watched this and I immediately asked Anna, I'm like, who is this?
You can sacrifice your sacro, working in the back row, bump and I don't tell you that. Kids, you gotta get a gimmick if you want to get ahead.
I like that they went with a deep cut from Gypsy. You know, you'd expect them to do Everything's Coming Up Roses or whatever, but the strippers for that song really are the secret weapon of any good production of Gypsy. Then you have Robert Preston doing Comedy Tonight from Forum.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
Then you have Beth Howland reprising her Broadway role in Company, singing Not Getting Married Today.
Pardon me, is everybody here? Because if everybody's here, I want to thank you all for coming to the wedding. I'd appreciate you going even more. I mean, you must know it's a better thing to do and not a word of it at all. I'm Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not because it wouldn't ruin anyone's Thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thank you all. Now it's back for the showers. Don't tell Paul that I'm not getting married today.
And then Larry Kurt, again, who came in to replace Dean Jones and Company, like pretty much immediately after it opened, does Being Alive.
Somebody hold me too close.
Somebody hold me too close.
Somebody force me to care.
And then, for Follies.
Oh my god. Dorothy Loudon needs to get locked up.
So first of all, she starts out by coming in. She's wearing like blue tights.
I was up all night painting these legs.
It's just a crazy performance. It's so good. And she gets a huge ovation afterwards.
Hey, Mr. Producer, I'm talking to you, sir. Hey, Alex, Jerry, everybody get off the phone. Steve! Another key change!
And she was in a play this season. She was in Noises Off. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
that,
wow,
I would have loved to see her in Noises Off.
Yeah, and I was kind of like, why is she at the Tony? But then I kind of realized that she...
Also, she should have been at every Tony's. I mean, she's definitely a ham, but, you know, she's in the right profession.
Yeah.
So then Julie Andrews sings Send in the Clowns, which is really the only thing she does all night.
Yeah.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair.
And then they just skip right over Pacific Overtures, do not acknowledge it exists. The second half is very ballad heavy. They do Not While I'm Around, Not a Day Goes By, and then it leads into Sunday. And now I'm going to try not to cry while I... talk about this.
Yeah.
So this is the act one closer, and I think a perfect song to perform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finally all of the dissonant elements, like all of the different characters that we've met, come together and form, you know, the vision of the painting. I want to read Sondheim's description of the lyric.
Sunday by the blue, purple, yellow, red water.
I've written that consists of one long incomplete sentence. I wanted it to be like the descriptive caption you might read in a museum next to the painting. I hoped that the tone would echo the permanence of the painting, which is not only a miracle of composition and an innovative technique, but also a satirical piece of reportage, something Lapine had pointed out to me. Seurat was as much a cartoonist as a painter. Once during the writing of each show, I cry at a notion, a word, a chord, a melodic idea, an accompaniment figure. Only once in each case, curiously enough, since I'm an easy crier at works of art, particularly those made by others. For example, with Anyone Can Whistle, it was the phrase, hold me, at the end of With So Little to Be Sure Of, against the chord underneath. In Follies, it was the word home in The Right Girl. In Pacific Overtures, the last line of Someone in a Tree. Only Cups of Tea in History and Someone in a Tree. In Merrily We Roll Along, the vamp to Our Time. In this show, it was the word forever in Sunday. I was suddenly moved by the contemplation of what these people would have thought if they'd known they were being immortalized, and in a major way, in a great painting. I still cry when I think about it. But then I cry at Animal Planet, often. In the HBO Sondheim documentary, Six by Sondheim, it also ends with the song and him sort of saying that and talking about it. And I always start crying when I watch that. And I watched it with my boyfriend a few months ago. And of course, like, I was crying at the end. And then I was trying to, like, explain to him the context that it happens in the show. And I was just, like, full on sobbing. Like, and then he puts her in the painting. And it was, you know, it gets me. It gets me every time.
The part of it that always makes me tear up. And if you haven't listened to the recording of this, it is absolutely one of the most beautiful things.
Oh, I have actually a quote about making the recording that I can read while you're finding this. I always am very interested in the process of making cast recordings, and hopefully you are too if you're listening to this. So there was a fun little article in the New Yorker about the process of creating this cast recording, and it was like an interview with Thomas Shepard, who has done most of Sondheim's cast recordings, and he said, "The basic challenge is to reflect the overall tone of the show and to give the listener a feeling of theatricality," he said. "That's why I never look at performers when I'm recording them. I want to make sure that what I hear is what I've seen on stage. If it's not, I try to talk to them, to get them to put the smile or the catch back into the voice. Once you've got the intention of a live performance, it's simply a matter of adjusting technically for sound, presence, and balance. In this recording, I used 3 sizes of orchestra, the show's 16-member orchestra for a few selections, a slightly expanded one for most of the other numbers, and considerably expanded one for the finale of each of the 2 acts. We've played the entire first act as a dramatic cantata, a continuous flow from music to dialogue to music, all of it building dramatically to the chorale that the entire cast sings as George presents its members to the audience in a live version of his painting. I felt that this moment should be set off, should sound more expansive than the music that has led up to it. So we added extra strings and put an additional reverb to project a feeling of space. You know, we go to a great deal of trouble to capture the intensity and the mood of a stage performance, and it always kills me when, after weeks of splicing hundreds of pieces of music together and mixing them into a coherent whole, somebody comes up and tells me that the finished product sounds just as if it had been recorded live right there in the theater."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I agree. Go listen to the cast album because it's beautiful.
Yeah. And as Julie Andrews says in the opening of this evening's Tony Awards, is what lasts are the songs.
Yeah. Did you find your...
Yes. Yes. I think that when Dot is leaving George to run off with Louis the Baker, there is a really beautiful song called "We Do Not Belong Together." George says, "I am not hiding behind my canvas, I'm living in it." Within the plays, there was another showdown between The Real Thing and David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross,
which we're going to talk about next week, unfortunately.
Yes. But The Real Thing won. It won 5 awards. Both productions had come over from the UK, whereas David Mamet is kind of a curmudgeon Chicago bred playwright. Tom Stoppard is a British playwright that had, as a child, immigrated to the UK from Eastern Europe. Saying that it came over is not necessarily true, because this was a new production that Tom Stoppard had worked on since it had premiered in the UK, and Mike Nichols directed. And the first preview was December 22nd, 1983. It opened on January 5th, 1984, and it ran for over a year. So, synopsis-wise, taking place in London in the 1980s, The Real Thing focuses on the passionate but never fully satisfying love between Henry, a playwright, and Annie, an actress. When they start an affair, Henry is already married to Charlotte, and Annie is married to Max. Soon they both divorce their partners and marry each other. Unfortunately, this new relationship still does not ultimately fulfill their needs. Meanwhile, Annie is devoted to freeing Brody, a Scottish soldier imprisoned for burning a memorial wreath during a protest. She is the reason he committed the crime in the first place, and subsequently feels responsible for his imprisonment. She encourages Brody to write an autobiographical play in the hopes that it will cause his story to become a political movement, and recruits a reluctant Henry to help ghostwrite. And through it all, Henry tries to handle the growing cynicism of his teenage daughter, Debbie. He also attempts to understand the reason that his first marriage fell apart in an effort to save his second.
It won Best Play, it won Best Director. It's funny, we just did 2 episodes in a row where Mike Nichols won Best Director, and there's sort of a reverse thing that now makes sense, where in his first speech, he's like,
"Max and Jenny, go to bed."
And in his 2005 speech, he's like, "Max and Jenny, you do not have to go to bed, because they're probably like 30 now."
That's actually so very cute.
Yeah.
It's had 2 Broadway revivals. The most recent one was very much panned, and there was a vaguely successful one in 2000.
I didn't get a chance to listen to the whole thing, but it's seems like vaguely misogynistic.
No, it totally is. I think that him writing this was a response to people saying that his work didn't have any humanness to it. I guess at this point, two of his biggest plays, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and Travesties, were written as these revisionist kind of satirical looks at Shakespeare and Oscar Wilde, respectively. So this was him writing himself, I guess, in a truer way than he ever has.
And he does not come off very well in it.
Yeah, no, he really comes off as an asshole.
So this won 3 out of 4 play acting Tonys. And you have Christine, when Christine Baranski comes up to accept her award, like, she always has a very, you know, mid-Atlantic accent, even though she is from Buffalo. But in this acceptance speech, she sounds straight up British. And I'm sure it's because she's been in this British play, but it's like, what are you, like, I love her very much. I think she's a treasure, but it's also like, what are you doing and where did that voice come from?
I must, however, with all my heart, thank the architects of my good fortune, Mike Nichols, Tom Stoppard, Manny Eisenberg, Yvette Schumer, Michael Oubre, and Jeff Hunter, and my 3 darling husbands, Jeremy Irons, Kenneth Welsh, and Matthew Coles.
Something that I read about him and his work in a profile: a Stoppard play tends to overflow with ideas, philosophical, scientific, literary, all the subjects that engage the writer's fertile and ever-curious mind. The plots tend to be difficult to pin down in terms of beginning, middle, and summations. In fact, he's admitted that he has problems thinking of stories. Every one of my plays is flawed by this. I have to exert myself enormously to construct a story and then tell it properly. With plot or without, all are dished up with enormous wit. Puns, allusions, wordplay of all kinds keep audiences alert and amused. As Stoppard himself once said about his love for words, "I really dig words more than I can speak them. There are no words to say how much I love words."
What a nerd.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's incredibly prolific. I think that he's written over 30 plays that have been produced. And I think that this one doesn't really stand the test of time.
But everyone, it seems like everyone was really crazy about it at the time.
It was really the hot ticket in town. And I think that considering that both this and Glengarry Glen Ross are incredibly misogynistic and kind of machismo in their own way, this is a little better take.
It at least has women in it.
I do think that some of the ideas within the play are interesting. Like, it opens in a kind of play within a play context where we are seeing a scene from one of the playwright's plays, and then we're made to figure out in the second scene that what we had just seen was a play. And the play that we see has a husband confronting his wife about her cheating, and then later on, at the end of the first act, we see like a scene of a husband confronting his wife about her cheating, but this time it's with real people. So, you know, I think that he is making interesting comments on art and artistry. The one thing that I was actually a little surprised about was that there are similarities between his life and the life of Henry. There are a number of parallels between Stoppard and his main character. Both are middle-aged playwrights known for their exact use of language. Both express doubts about Marxism and the politics of the left, and both undertake work outside the theater to keep up with their comfortable lifestyles and pay alimony to their ex-wives. With these similarities established, it is only a small step to compare Henry's fictional situation with that of his creator. Both men take up with another man's wife and find happiness while retaining a strong relationship with their children. In Stoppard's case, this is reinforced by his relationship with Felicity Kendall, the actress who played Annie in the original staging. Although, as Stoppard notes, he developed his plot before Kendall took the role.
All right, I think that's all we need to say about that.
Also, the way that he paints the Marxist character in this is, like, totally unfair, and I think he's a neoliberal asshole.
Oh, I think for sure he is.
He is like, does my play need to be political? Like, art doesn't need to be political. Art just needs to be about the heart. And he just, like, paints this political revolutionary or this activist who's writing a play as a complete idiot. where it totally doesn't have to be black and white like that. Like, of course, there is bad political art. Tom Stoppard, you won a lot of Tonys in 1984. Your plays are still being revived pretty much every year. And you have also been knighted in 1997. But
I like this, how this is switched to a second person address to him.
I know. This is,
telling him all this stuff he knows about himself.
Yeah, this is your life. Love Dick. But for Tom Stoppard.
Oh, man. He would be a good figure for that.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's time to wrap it up. I think we've said a lot. We've said too much. No, we've said the right amount. And next week, we're going to talk about all the things we didn't talk about. We're going to talk about Baby. We're going to talk about the tap dance kid.
Candor and Ebb. The rink.
Yep. Maybe a little noises off. Okay. So follow us on Twitter and Instagram, My Little Tonys.
If you have any questions or comments, DM us, or you could reach us at mylittletonyspodcast@gmail.com. Like us and rate us on iTunes.
Yeah.
Please subscribe.
Yes. And we love, like us. We love hearing your comments. They've been very lovely so far. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.